From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA Senior National Correspondent Jim Malone. Our guest on this edition of the program is William A. Galston, Chair in Governance Studies and Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution, and that's a public policy group based here in Washington. Our topic, the state of the race for the White House in the run-up to the Democratic and Republican National Conventions in July. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is the official presumptive nominee for the Democrats, and real estate mogul and reality TV star Donald J. Trump is the presumptive Republican nominee. This week, we learned that Donald Trump is trailing Hillary Clinton in fundraising, polls, and statewide organization. According to Yahoo News, together, Mr. Trump and the Republican National Committee brought in about $18.6 million in the month of May, including another loan from the candidate. Clinton and the Democratic National Committee raised more than double that. His campaign started June with $1.3 million in the bank, hers with $42 million. And as he confronts challenges in the general election and after months of concerns from Republican Party officials, Mr. Trump fired his controversial campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski. And many Republicans still harbor misgivings about Mr. Trump as their standard bearer. Hundreds of pledged delegates appear poised to try to get a rule passed to be able to vote their consciences and nominate another candidate at the upcoming Republican National Convention. Meantime, Hillary Clinton faces her own set of daunting challenges. She exemplifies the consummate insider, a former First Lady, Senator, and Secretary of State in the year of the outsider. Many voters perceive her as untrustworthy or dishonest, and she still needs to win over the majority of those who voted for her rival during the Democratic primary, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. We'll talk with Bill Galston, an expert on domestic policy, political campaigns, and elections, about all this and more. And he joins us from a studio at the Brookings Institution. Bill Galston, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
And I'm delighted, as always, to welcome my colleague Jim Malone, who follows the campaigns.
Hi, Carol.
Bill Galston, you've seen a lot of campaigns in your lifetime.
That's for sure.
Have you ever seen one in which both candidates of both parties are so reviled by each side as Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump?
Nobody has. The phrase uncharted waters has become the cliche of campaign 2016. And political practitioners have had to throw out their rule book, and political scientists have had to throw out their hard-won generalizations. And we're all trying our best to figure out what's going on without the usual signposts to guide us.
And now that the primaries are over, how do the strategies change for each candidate, and who do you think has a better chance in the general election campaign so far?
Well, Mr. Trump has a core of fervent supporters, and his challenge is to expand beyond that core. His problem is that the issue positions and the mode of presentation of those positions has simultaneously energized his core supporters and repelled just about everyone else. And it's a real question, it seems to me, whether he can modulate and moderate his approach enough to build out from that core, which is not nearly enough to win the election. Hillary Clinton, it seems to me, has, number one, the challenge of reuniting a Democratic Party that got more deeply divided to some extent in the course of the primary campaign. I don't think that's her biggest challenge. I think she's up to it. If you compare where she stands with Sanders supporters right now to where Barack Obama stood with her supporters 8 years ago, she's actually ahead of the game. The bigger challenge, it seems to me, is going to be to reach out beyond the base of the Democratic Party, which once again is not large enough to win an election. She's not particularly popular with independents. She hopes to do well among more moderate Republicans, especially suburban Republican women, many of whom express visceral dislike for Donald Trump for reasons related in part to what he said about women during the campaign and well before that as well. It's a balancing act, though, because if she reaches out to moderate Republicans, she may antagonize some of the Sanders supporters who don't particularly trust her professions of progressivism. They think she is too much of a centrist, too much of a compromiser. So keeping her balances between those competing political imperatives, I think, will be the heart of her campaign.
Now I'd like to turn to my colleague Jim for a question.
Thanks, Carol, and Dr. Galson, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. And I wanted to know, with such intense interest here in the United States and around the world in this election campaign, people obviously, I think many were surprised by the rise of Donald Trump in the primaries. And a number of them are starting to wonder if he could win. And if he does win in November, I mean, what would that look like? What would he have to do? Which groups would have to come out to support him in sufficient numbers in order for him to become the next president of the United States?
He would have to do much better among women than he's now doing. He would have to mobilize a record turnout of white working class voters, and he'd have to get a lot closer to the meager level of support among minorities that Mitt Romney enjoyed in 2012 than he now is. Any one of those tasks would be daunting. Put them together, and they're a pretty steep hill to climb, in my opinion.
And, you know, it's just interesting that after the 2012 election, the Republicans did what they sort of referred to as their own autopsy on what went wrong in the Romney election against President Obama for his reelection. And one of the big conclusions was they kind of too reliant on the white vote and not sufficiently reaching out to minority voters. But in the Trump case, it almost seems like he's decided to try to double down, especially with these white working class voters who somewhat are receding in terms of their numbers in the electorate.
There's no question about that. And the chairman of the Republican National Committee, Reince Priebus, who commissioned that famous autopsy that recommended a more accommodating posture towards minorities, a more relaxed attitude towards immigration, some reconciliation with the emerging majority of the country on same-sex marriage and gay rights, etc., he must be tearing his hair out right now, even though he's playing the good, loyal soldier, as he must in his position, because Donald Trump's campaign has put a minus sign in front of each and every one of the principal recommendations in that Republican self-study document. And so he doesn't represent a step forward from Mitt Romney. In many respects, he represents a step backwards. If Mr. Trump loses the election, then the Republican Party, after three consecutive defeats in national elections, I think will have no choice but to enter seriously into the reexamination that was aborted prematurely after the 2012 election. In my experience, and this is true not just in the United States, but in other democracies that I've studied, established political parties reach a kind of breaking point. There is usually a critical mass within the party that says to itself at that point, we can't go on this way. We can't keep on losing. We're now staring the prospect of more than a decade out of power in the face, and we are not willing to accept the inevitability of future defeats. We must examine ourselves and we must change.
Well, before we even predict the outcome of this election, Bill Galston, we have yet to even get to the conventions in July. So speaking of that, there still is a movement to dump Trump, so to speak. You know, we have the Never Trumpers, those within the Republican Party that just can't bring themselves to support him, but nor could they vote for Hillary Clinton. So what about this proposal that a rule be passed to allow Republican delegates to vote their conscience? Is that a possibility? How likely a scenario is that?
It's logically possible. It's consistent with the rules and procedures of the Republican Party. But all the insiders I've talked to tell me that it's extremely unlikely that it will happen. Republicans who are opposed to Trump are now faced with two almost equally unpalatable choices. One is to swallow hard and let him become the nominee, and the other is to try to prevent him from becoming the nominee, and in the process, perhaps ripping up their party. Because Mr. Trump's supporters at the convention, who will be very numerous, will be beyond outraged if someone who won the nomination according to the rules of the party were deprived of the party's nomination through some maneuver at the convention. I can't imagine a step better calculated to split the Republican Party, to spur an independent candidacy or an outright rebellion on the part of Mr. Trump and his supporters. So the never-Trumpers at this point have no place to turn. Stopping him might well do more damage to the Republican Party than not stopping him, and they have no third force or third candidate to coalesce around. So I think that unless Mr. Trump does something even more egregious, that he is likely to be the nominee despite a spirited rules challenge.
I want you to look back, Bill Galston, and try to explain how we got to this point, the Trump phenomenon. Now, you wrote a column for the Wall Street Journal entitled How Obama's Economy Spawned Trump. That's a very interesting set of hypotheses. But what about the Republican Party? To what extent did they themselves spawn this phenomenon?
The best way to answer that question is to do a little bit of quick history. 50 years ago, the group in the population and the electorate that we call the white working class, white voters in the United States with less than a college education, many of whom were in the manufacturing sector in 1965, have migrated from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party. There are various reasons for that, some of them having to do with the civil rights movement, some of them having to do with the Vietnam War, some of them having to do with the counterculture that arose in the United States starting in the late 1960s. But at any rate, they used to be firmly attached to the Democratic Party, and now they are the base of the Republican Party. These are voters who have experienced an economic downturn. It started in the 1980s with the beginning of foreign competition in the steel and auto sector, and it has accelerated. It was moved into really high gear when China was allowed to join the World Trade Organization in 2000 and began massive exports to the United States early in the 21st century. Since then, millions of manufacturing workers have lost their jobs, and most of the decline occurred not during the Great Recession, but before it. So you have large numbers of less educated workers who have not been able to participate at all in the slow, modest gains that have been made since the end of the Great Recession. Many of them lost jobs that they'd had for decades and haven't been able to find any jobs to replace them. The ones who have gotten reemployed are typically in jobs that pay considerably less than did the jobs that they lost 5 or 6 or 7 years ago. They are very unhappy about what has happened to them, and in many cases, what has happened to their communities, which used to be organized around a handful of manufacturing plants, most of which have shut down. At the same time, they've seen social decline, the rise of opioid drug addiction, the fracturing of marriages, the decline of main streets, and on top of that, frequently, new immigrants moving in who don't look like them, many of whom have not learned much English. They are passionate about changing the fundamental direction of the country, which they think is leaving them out. And they see Mr. Trump as the vehicle to disrupt the status quo and change the direction of the country. And that's why they're so passionately for him.
Indeed, and he is certainly the antithesis of the Republican establishment and, of course, the Democratic establishment. You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is William Galston. He's chair in governance studies and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. And Bill Galston was also a former policy advisor to President Bill Clinton and other presidential candidates. I'm Carol Castiel, and joining me on the program is VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone. And this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/podcast. @PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter @CarolCastielVOA or connect with us on Facebook. And here's a shout out to Ier Yurk. He's a loyal listener from Phnom Penh, Cambodia. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send an email to PCUSA@VOANews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And now a question from Jim.
Your explanation of the rise of Trump was pretty interesting, and it got me thinking, too, that in some ways it's not simply a phenomenon in the Republican Party, this anti-establishment kind of yearning for change, not liking the way things are. I mean, we saw that really driving the Bernie Sanders campaign for somewhat different reasons. But in some ways, I mean, both Sanders and Trump are sort of classic outsiders. And there does seem to be a little overlap there in terms of some aspects of their appeal and who they're resonating with.
Some, but based on the surveys that I've read, I wouldn't make too much of that. I would be very surprised if a high percentage of Sanders supporters ended up turning their backs on Hillary Clinton and voting for Donald Trump. I can imagine them more readily voting for a third party candidate, a candidate farther to the left than Hillary Clinton, than I can voting for Donald Trump, who on a number of cultural issues, the issue of immigration in particular, represents the antithesis of the kind of diversity, 21st century American society, that Sanders supporters, especially the young ones, have grown up in and very much prize. But let me take your point and expand it. Not only are the sentiments driving the Trump campaign present to some extent within the Democratic Party as well, represented by the Sanders campaign, but you can see this at work in advanced democracies throughout the world, particularly in the UK and in many European countries as well. You have these strong and rising pockets of discontent, most of which are rooted in globalization and its consequences for the traditional manufacturing sector, but also reflecting deep concerns about societal changes produced in large measure by large immigration flows. That is one of the issues very much at play in Great Britain, but it's also fueling nationalist reactions, and in some respects, anti-European Union reactions throughout European countries. And I could go through each country and list the leaders and parties that have made a lot of progress in recent years based on those sentiments. So I think all of the advanced democracies are in the same boat, and you can see everywhere aspects of this phenomenon that in the United States has crystallized around Donald Trump.
Let me pick up on that theme, Bill Galston, because Mr. Trump gave a speech this past week excoriating Hillary Clinton, saying that she is the most corrupt person to ever run for the office of the president. So that, but also denigrating her tenure as Secretary of State, blasting her foreign policy credentials, and of course talking about trade. And he talks about America first. He has a very protectionist policy. Again, you know, this anti-immigration rhetoric saying that he would ban Muslims, build a wall to keep the Mexicans out. I mean, this is still standard fare in his speeches.
Correct.
And he makes declarative statements without bringing much evidence to justify many of them. But it definitely resonates among this cohort of people about whom you're speaking. But at what point does he have to get beyond making such declarative statements and sort of pandering to his constituents and his supporters and really start laying out some policies for a general election campaign?
Maybe at no point. Let's take the speech you just referred to. As most of the world knows, at his famous massive rallies, Mr. Trump generally talks off the cuff, prepared texts, and I suspect without notes in most cases. So it's a very interesting kind of stream of consciousness presentation. The speech that he gave earlier this week was a written text, which he followed. He had the opportunity to go beyond the headlines and the applause lines that had characterized his campaign, but he didn't. He chose not to. He doesn't apparently think that it's necessary to go beyond these broad indications of what kind of direction he would follow if he became president.
Well, what about his notion that he can translate his business acumen and real estate experience into creating jobs, increasing wages, preventing what he calls unsavory immigration to this country? I mean, can he translate those skills into being a disciplined chief executive and commander in chief, which is probably what is needed to run the country?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because to some extent, the 2016 presidential election is a rerun of the 2012 presidential election. Mitt Romney's calling card, really, was his private sector experience. And he did make the argument that his private sector experience, which was much more extensive than his public sector experience, gave him the skills and the insight to help repair the American economy. Unfortunately, before he had a chance to make that argument, the Obama campaign characterized his business career as one of predatory capitalism, where he was interested only in creating value for shareholders and didn't much care what happened to the workers and the enterprises his equity firm took over. And that undermined the core of his claim to be an effective president. The Clinton campaign is trying to do the same thing to Trump. Earlier this week, Hillary Clinton gave a speech in which she offered her own characterization of Mr. Trump's business career and accused him of being a scam artist who had made big promises time after time that he had not been able to fulfill, that he usually left communities worse off than he found them, that he always found a way to get out of a losing situation without personal damage, but he left damage, including bankrupt corporations, behind him. So she is trying to do to Trump what President Obama's forces did to Mitt Romney, with great success, more success than I thought possible at the time.
It's interesting, too, listening to Mr. Trump. He's appropriating lines that she's used against him, against her, except this time criticizing her public service experience, saying that she doesn't have the judgment or temperament to be president, which is what she accuses him of not having. He said that she ran the State Department like a personal hedge fund, you know, in exchange for cash for her husband's foundation. So again, these are interesting rhetorical tactics on both sides.
That is true, but one of the basic principles of rhetoric is that the message is judged in light of the messenger. It is true that a substantial share of the electorate does not trust former Secretary of State Clinton. It's also true that an even larger share of the electorate doesn't trust Donald J. Trump. And so when he accuses her of every misdeed under the sun, a lot of people will be disinclined to believe him because they don't trust a word that comes out of his mouth. So we will see how far negative campaigning will get either candidate in a year in which neither is particularly trusted by the electorate.
There are some headwinds for Hillary Clinton, I would say, in this election, though. I mean, you mentioned the trust issue for her. She's a well-known figure, but she's not new. Sometimes people want change. The polls seem to indicate people are looking for change. And after two terms of one president, there's often a party switch in the offing. So there are some issues there for her to deal with as she tries to succeed President Obama.
That's absolutely true. And as a matter of fact, political scientists who've studied what's sometimes called the third term curse have reached the conclusion that it is a real drag on the electoral prospects of anybody who's running to succeed a two-term incumbent president of his or her own party, and that the drag is on the order of 4 percentage points. So if this were a normal election, it would turn Barack Obama's 51% of the vote in 2012 into something like 47% of the vote for the Democrat running to succeed him. But there's a lot going on the other side of the balance sheet, including the fact that demographic changes in the United States continue to move in favor of the Democrats. The share of the white electorate is declining at the rate of about 2 percentage points every 4-year presidential cycle. The share of minorities is growing. There is evidence that Latinos and Latinas in the United States are being mobilized to register to vote or even to qualify for citizenship so that they can be voting members of the electorate in time for November. So Mr. Trump's mobilization of white working class voters appears to be creating a counter mobilization. It's also the case that even when voters want change, as they certainly do this year, there's a two-step calculus that they apply to their choice. Number one, who is the candidate for change? And the answer to that question in 2016 is Donald J. Trump. But then the second question is this the kind of change we want? And do we feel safe and confident that the challenger can deliver that change? And I suspect that for many voters who want change, stumbles at that second step.
And Bill Galston, right now at least, Mr. Trump is trailing in money in an organizational ground game. Even the Republican National Committee, we're not sure, you know, how far they're going to get behind him. They certainly want to retain their hold on the House of Representatives and Senate. So how important are those factors, too, as detrimental to him?
In any conventional election, they would be huge negatives. He clearly believes that a version of the strategy that brought him to the Republican Party's nomination against tremendous odds will serve him equally well during the general election. I personally believe he's wrong about that. There's a huge difference between winning a party's nomination and winning a general election, and that the conventional wisdom that you have to shift gears is true. It is certainly the case, moreover, that even if Mr. Trump can do reasonably well with a totally unconventional strategy, that more conventional candidates running for the House and Senate on the Republican ticket cannot do so. They need money. They need organization. They need help. They need a solvent Republican National Committee that can give them that help. And so Mr. Trump may say that he can self-fund his campaign, but what about the rest of the Republicans? So this is the week that something like panic broke out among the leaders of the Republican Party as they begin to contemplate the prospect that they are simply not going to have enough money and enough troops to run normal conventional campaigns for the House and the Senate and other important offices.
And one last question, Bill Galston. If Mr. Trump is not elected, how much will that hurt other Republicans seeking office or trying to be reelected?
That's an interesting question. I am inclined to believe that in these highly partisan times, that the amount of ticket splitting is going to be lower than it usually is. On the other hand, Mr. Trump is a very different kind of candidate. And I could imagine voters in Midwestern states like Ohio and Pennsylvania turning their backs on him while reelecting Republican incumbents. And if you look at the state of Florida, recent surveys have Hillary Clinton out in front of Mr. Trump by a very considerable margin. But at the same time, Senator Marco Rubio, who re-entered the race for Senate in Florida earlier this week, is leading his likely Democratic challengers by a larger margin as Hillary Clinton leads Donald Trump. So this may be the year that worried Republicans are able to put enough distance between themselves and their party's nominee to survive, however badly he does.
William Galston is Chair in Governance Studies and Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution. Bill Galston, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your terrific insights about the election.
My pleasure as always.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Chiang Wang. And joining me on the program was VOA Senior National Correspondent Jim Malone. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.